begin the public testimony on Senate Bill 101. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 101. Janet, will you give a brief overview of the bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Senate Bill 101 is at the request of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department and spells out operator permit requirements for operators of Class 1 ATVs and Class 3 ATVs. The Class 1s are quads, and the Class 3s are off-road motorcycles or dirt bikes. So if you can keep that in mind as you go through. It would require operators of both Class 1s and Class 3s that are under the age of 16 to have an operator's permit and also to be accompanied by an adult with an appropriate operator's permit or driver's license. It requires other operators to have the operator's permit on premises open to the public. This would be a new requirement for adults. You have at your place also the Dash 1 amendments and the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments phase in the permit and training requirements between the years of 2009 and 2014 based on the age of the operator. The Dash 2 amendments also provide an exemption from the training and permit requirement for riders that are 16 or older that have at least 5 years' experience and who can pass an equivalency exam. And then back to the original bill that provisions, the bill would also disallow a person under the age of 7 from operating a quad on premises open to the public. And just for your information, the dirt bike operation under the age of 7 is already disallowed in current law. There's an offense created for endangering a Class 1 ATV operator. And that would be for the parent, legal guardian, or a person legally responsible for a child's safety if a child under 16 operates a quad in violation of the requirements that are in the bill. And finally, Mr. Chair, the original bill raises the age of the child from 12 to 16 for the existing offense of endangering a Class 3 or dirt bike operator. And applies that violation consistent through the rest of the bill on premises open to the public. I think, Mr. Chair, that is, we do have one letter at your place to enter into the record. And I think, other than that, the agency is ready to testify.
Very good. Thank you, Janet. Are there questions from the committee for Janet? Okay, seeing none, we will proceed to our public testimony. Tim Wood, Kylene Stone from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Wood. I'm the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and with me this afternoon is Kylene Stone. Kylene is the assistant director of the department of our recreation programs and planning, and the ATV program falls under her responsibility. Kylene will be giving the testimony. We have this is one of four bills that the agency is introducing this session with regard to ATV program. Three of them had been filed in the House. One requires operators to wear a helmet. Another has to do with restricting passengers on vehicles to the number of seats for which the vehicle was designed, and a requirement for titling of ATVs as well. So with that, I'll introduce Kylene, and she'll present the agency's testimony.
For the record, my name is Kylene Stone. I'm Assistant Director for Recreation Programs and Planning, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here seeking your support for Senate Bill 101, including proposed amendments 1 and 2. The effects of this bill include requiring ATV and dirt bike riders to complete safety training, setting 7 as the minimum age for drivers of ATVs, requiring adult supervision of young drivers, and requiring each vehicle operator to possess a permit to operate ATVs and dirt bikes on lands open to public use. We believe this bill will improve safety and reduce injuries to off-highway vehicle riders and their passengers through increased understanding of safety issues related to the operation of their vehicles. The safety training intents of the bill are accomplished through the added requirements for all ATV and dirt bike operators to hold valid operator permits that are issued under the state park statutes ORS 39570 and ORS 39575. To receive an operator's permit under those statutes, a person must complete a safety training course as established by the state parks. Under current law, to ride an ATV or dirt bike on public lands, a person may either have an operator permit, or they may just hold a valid driver's license, or they may merely be accompanied by a licensed operator who's over 18 years old. Through our management of the ATV account grant program at State Parks, we've heard consistent claims from ATV enthusiasts that the existing capacity to offer training needed to issue the operator permits is inadequate. Therefore, in 2006, we commissioned a study with Oregon State University to determine just what the feasibility of instituting a comprehensive training program for all riders of ATVs would do for us. And for the record, I've provided you a summary of the recommendations in that report. OSU looked at all existing but extremely limited data that exists right now for ATV accidents. And they reviewed best practices from other states' efforts to improve safety for ATV riding, and they conducted a series of surveys with subject area experts. Researchers also surveyed the providers of existing training programs in the state of Oregon. And right now there are two major providers of training, safety training for ATV riders in the state. The ASI, which is the ATV Safety Institute, provides hands-on training for people who've recently purchased quads, four-wheel kinds of ATVs, and then the Motorcycle Foundation Dirt Bike School provides training courses for people who've recently purchased dirt bikes. And both of these organizations receive primary funding from the manufacturers. Researchers learned that among these two organizations, there are 27 ATV and 14 dirt bike instructors that serve the needs of all of Oregon's riding population. Simply put, there are not enough instructors to provide adequate hands-on OHV training in Oregon. If this legislation is enacted, ATV and dirt bike training will be modeled after the Oregon State Marine Board Training Program, which is an online program. And according to the OSU assessment report, an online training program that focuses on understanding hazards posed by various terrain, as well as operator judgment, accountability, and ethics, will have the most far-reaching impact in reducing accidents and death. The online training program will effectively augment the existing hands-on training, and that will continue to be offered by ASI and the Motorcycle Foundation. The governor's recommended budget for our department, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, includes two policy option packages that will finance the coordination and development of the training programs and also the implementation of this legislation. One of the packages includes staffing for an ATV safety training coordinator. And that person will be collaborating with a broad base of stakeholders, including riders, ATV enthusiasts, law enforcement personnel, ATV and dirt bike dealers and manufacturers, natural resource experts, rental agents, academia, and other training providers, and will develop a multifaceted training program that provides options for meeting the training requirements. Another package draws from existing ATV account funds to develop and administer the program so that users will not be charged to participate in this training. To accommodate Oregon's large number of ATV and dirt bike operators, we find it will be necessary to phase in this program, and we anticipate Second Amendment that you have in front of you does that. And then provisions will also be made to allow experienced riders to demonstrate their abilities in lieu of going through the training program. These issues have been addressed through the two amendments to the original bill. Also, as a result of the OSU research, we have already started collaborating with the Department of Human Services, Division of Health Services, and with various law enforcement agencies to identify how to achieve better off-highway vehicle crash and injury reporting. With better reporting of off-highway vehicle-related deaths and accidents, more comprehensive and detailed data will help us measure safety training effectiveness and can be used to guide our future safety training strategies. And then finally, we plan to allocate additional ATV funds to law enforcement agencies so that we can better enforce these new provisions and all provisions of ATV statute. We've met with many ATV constituents and others to determine support for this legislative concept. Support and encouragement has been received from many state and federal agencies, as well as from individual riders and user groups. Our department has a committee of ATV enthusiasts that looks at the allocation of resources of ATV funds out of our budget, and that group, the ATV Account Allocation Committee, also supports this bill. And we believe that early stakeholder concerns appear to have been resolved with the amendments. However, a remaining point of disagreement still does exist as to where to set the age limit for children who ride ATVs. This legislation establishes the minimum age at 7 and is consistent with existing dirt bike minimum age regulations. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department respectfully requests your support in passing Senate Bill 101, and we'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Can you take over?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've read through the materials, and I'm trying to get some understanding of exactly what's motivating the department to go forward with this particular thing. It doesn't seem like there's an uptick in the number of injuries. And, in fact, if you look at what's actually the injuries, it's more towards bicycles. It seems like to me that bicycles would be a place where we could reduce injuries before we went to ATVs. It seems like to me that, based on the statistics I've read and the materials I've read, that people who are investing in ATVs are making sure their kids have helmets, investing in safety, training their kids. If there's anything where you'd be protecting kids, it seems like it'd be towards the bicycle side rather than the ATV side. I'm trying to figure out, in all the data that I've gotten through my office in the last few months, I can't see, there's some sad stories, but I can't see that the overriding public purpose to bring this forward, especially without accurate information in the studies. So I was just wondering why this came forward. What's the impetus to make this go forward?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think there is probably not universal agreement on what is an acceptable level of accidents and injuries for children or for adults who ride ATVs. And there really was quite a bit of impetus on the department from the ATV community, particularly through our account allocation committee, to help to provide additional safety training and take measures to improve safety conditions for riders. And one of the best ways to improve safety conditions for riders is to make them all more aware of their rights and responsibilities as they ride their vehicles.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I'm trying to just follow through. The piece that you just handed out to us, the Oregon Off-Highway Vehicle State Safety Recommendations, and I'm just making sure I'm trying to follow this. On page 2, it has a graph of the ATV-related deaths, which since 1984 has basically fluctuated somewhere between 10 and 0, and it doesn't seem to be that much of a trend upwards. And yet, if you look at page 4, you have the number of ATVs sold in the state, and that's skyrocketed. So it seems like to me that what we're seeing is even though we're having more and more ATVs sold, we're having higher and higher safety rate and less actual injury per ATV. It seems like the industry is actually getting safer in the free market itself. It seems like to me that the riders themselves are doing a great job of self-policing when you consider the number of ATVs being sold.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the only comparison here is that the first graph, is really related to ATV-related deaths, and we don't have systematic data on the accident, the level of accidents, but we have anecdotal data, particularly from law enforcement, that would indicate that we are seeing rising numbers of accidents, and it's good news that we're not seeing skyrocketing deaths, but we're trying to sort of stave that off, and so that's really the intent behind this. Thank you.
Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read the bills, they apply only to public land. Is that? Can you define that for me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stark, yes. Those would be any lands that are open to the public for the purpose of riding ATVs. So that includes, for example, U.S. Forest Service has lands where there are ATV trails. There are also private clubs in the state that operate lands and open them up for the public to ride on trails on those lands as well. As long as the properties are open to the public for the purpose of riding ATVs or dirt bikes, then this bill would apply there. It does not apply, for example, on farmland or on private property that is not available for the public to recreate on.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Can you give me a percentage of the public lands that would apply to this, that this bill would apply to, that are under the control of the State Parks Department?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, State Parks actually does not operate any ATV riding areas directly. We provide funds to the land managers who provide those services, and so it would be none of State Park property, and it would be strictly on federal riding areas and other designated riding areas. Counties also operate several of these riding areas.
Mr. Chair, Are the folks that would have to actually have to enforce this, are they here to testify in support of this bill that you've presented to this committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I'm not sure that they have signed up to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Want to go ahead? Yeah. Anything to add? Okay. If no other questions, we may have some later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Terry DeWitt and Linda I'll wait. Let's just do Terry right now.
Good afternoon. My name is Terry DeWitt. I'm better known throughout the ATV community as Quad Daddy. I guess that pretty well states why I'm here. My nickname is Quad Daddy. Okay. I believe in the training program. The part of it that I have a problem with is age requirement. To me, it's the responsible parent that is going to be the person that trains the kids. You can't take a 7-year-old child, buy him a quad, take him to safety training, and expect him to even know how to operate it when he gets there. Before he can take safety training, he has to be somewhat instructed by the parent to operate his ATV correctly. The emphasis of this bill should be on training us, the parents. Make sure we know what correct rider fit is, what size of ATV our child should be on. Make sure that we know what the correct safety equipment, gear, boots, helmets, gloves, whatever, that these children should have. If we focus on teaching the parents, the kids will learn. Then, when the time is appropriate, we do just like we did when we got our driver's license. We take our children down. They pass a test. If they pass, they get their license. If they don't pass, they don't get their license. What that age is, I don't want to debate. That's something that needs to be discussed and worked out. I have presented myself to volunteer to help with state parks to help develop a proper training program. I will devote as much time to this as absolutely necessary. And that is the whole goal here. Teach the parents to be responsible, to know what is required. Let us train our kids at the appropriate time that the kids are old enough to ride on their own. Let them show that they can. And then let them do it. That's really all I have to say.
Thank you,
Chair.
Yes, Senator Lawrence Sanders.
Having had children, and one developed a little bit faster than the other, some were ready to do things before others were ready to do things. So I want to have this clarified. You feel that there should be no age limit?
Correct.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
It's.
And what is the youngest age that you're aware of where we've gotten someone on an ATV?
My son started riding. He got his first gasoline-powered ATV 2 months before his 4th birthday.
Is that right? Thank you.
And has been riding safely ever since.
Okay. Any other questions for Terry? Thank you very much, sir. Okay. Let's. I'm going to ask Joanne, is it Fairchild, to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Chair Metzger and members of the committee, my name is Joanne Fairchild. I am a trauma nurse coordinator responsible for injury prevention at Legacy Emanuel Hospital. I chair the Oregon Safe Kids Legislative Committee. I head the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program, and I am a former flight nurse and emergency department. nurse, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 101 with a few reservations that I'll get to. I have to say right off the bat, I agree with Quad Daddy that the education needs to be of the parents, at least two, in addition to the youth. Parents really are the key to their safety, and we see very well-meaning parents make some decisions that put their children in at risk merely because they don't know that that's what they're doing. So I just want to agree with that. We have seen in the trauma world a rapid increase in the number of children and adults coming through our doors with ATV injuries. When I go on rounds in our trauma ICU, in our pediatric ICU, I hear from care providers, why aren't you doing something, knowing that I'm the injury prevention person? Why aren't you doing something about this? Why aren't you doing something about the kids that are coming through our doors with these injuries from ATVs? And yes, we see more children from bike crashes, but again, if you look at per exposure, almost every child in our state drives a bike. That is not true of ATVs. And I don't have any statistics on per vehicle since we don't have bicycle registration, but I see kids on bikes every day in the Portland metropolitan area, and I have yet to see one on an ATV, thank goodness, in that area since it's not an appropriate riding place anyway. So this bill is a step towards at least making our children a little bit safer. I'm concerned, though, that the training will be an online kind of training and not on vehicle. And again, I'm advocating for education of the parent and or guardian so they will understand the issues. ATVs are not toys. They are potentially very dangerous vehicles. They are unstable, and the problem with children is these vehicles are rolling over on them. Plus, they go speeds that children don't have the developmental capabilities to handle. I remember when I was first a flight nurse and I got called out for a 5-year-old with a very severe brain injury. He was on a dirt bike, and his father came running over to the helicopter screaming, "You have to do something for my child." And I said, you know, let me check out the situation. And as I'm going towards my patient, the child is, the father saying, you know, I was going 40 miles an hour and he just rode right in front of me. Why would he do that? And I just wanted to scream, he's five. He's a child. They just don't understand the issues. I would like to request that Oregon Safe Kids and trauma nurses talk tough to be involved in developing the training that parents and children will go to. These injuries are real. The research is clear, but to me this isn't research. These are the real patients that we're seeing and their families. The article that was written by Dr. Mullins that documents the rise that we have seen in injuries from ATVs in the trauma system, so severe injuries, also has information on what the training should look like, this medical part of the training that talks about the real people and the real situations, and then how we can avoid these tragedies. I am still concerned, though, that we are ignoring the issue of children under 16 being allowed to drive these adult-size ATVs that go so fast. Again, children do not have the mental development to understand the consequences. And just want to say, are any of you ever around teenagers? Have you watched them do something that's not the brightest thing you've ever seen them do? And you looked at them and said, why did you do that? What did they say? I don't know. And this isn't new. Bill Cosby did a comedic routine on this back when I was a teenager. And it's because the part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex, where we have judgment, reasoning, logic, developmental skills, doesn't start developing till we reach puberty. It doesn't finish till our mid to late 20s, which explains some really stupid stuff I did back then. But that's the issue, and that's the issue we're trying to get to. So I am asking you to at least be willing to look at Senate Bill 49 or look at components of that that might be partners with this bill, because I know that our bottom line is we all want our kids to be safe. So thank you very much, and I'd be willing to entertain questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fairchild, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Metzger. Joanne, thank you very much for coming in. I, with the Safe Kids Legislative Committee, I'd like to ask kind of questions on how you prioritize things. When I think of dangers to kids, where parents get their kids involved in activities that are dangerous, things like snow skiing, things like riding bicycles, and then potentially ATVs, it seems like to me that when I think of where kids get hurt most often is things like getting on the snow slopes. I know I've been up on the snow slopes with a three-year-old cutting right off in front of me. And the training differential is kind of, to me, is significant. I was wondering how the Safe Kids Legislative Committee comes up with picking out ATVs out of things that parents engage their kids in that may be risky, and whether you analyzed the priority of this type of injury versus the other injuries we see, like bicycles and snow skiing.
Senator Metzger, Senator George, we look at the top causes of either death or severe injury coming through the trauma system to children that have a potential fix. And so we came to the legislature a number of years ago and asked for bike helmets for kids on bikes to help make that a safer activity, knowing that it's good for our children exercise-wise to be on bicycles. And since head injuries were the number one cause of death on bikes, we could lower that risk to children. I would love to have a bicycle licensing program, but I am told that there's no way we could ever afford to do that. So I work in other ways on that issue. I'm very active, as is Safe Kids organization, in safe routes to schools, looking at how we get our children to and from school in a way that's good for them and the environment, but doing it safely. How can we make them safer as pedestrians? How can we make them safer as bicyclists? And I work with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Community Cycling Center to make sure that as many kids as possible get training on how to be good at that. So you look at things that have a potential fix. We also look at things that are rapidly rising causes of injuries coming through the trauma system. And that's how ATVs got our attention, because that injury rate has been rapidly rising. And I fear that if we don't do something now, take a stand now, look at the research, and I have a stack of research articles, none of which say that kids under 16 are safe on adult-size ATVs, regardless of their training. But if we look at that, then we formulate what might keep our kids safer, and then we institute that. And then I echo what Parks and Rec says. Then we have a surveillance system so that we know if we're missing things. But this is why we came to the legislature, and you'll be hearing it hopefully soon, improving our child occupant protection laws for children. Our laws are good in this state, but we're learning that they can be even better. That's why we came back to expand the helmet bill to cover other vehicles that children were on to make them safer. So that's how we pick what our issues for that year are. We look at what's coming through the doors of our trauma unit that have a potential fix, and then try to do that.
If I could, Mr. Chair, follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I guess my point to you is that what I'm most concerned about, just I don't own an ATV myself, but some members of my family do, and my niece was in here lobbying me against your bill today. So, and my niece has a lot of influence with me. The fact is that what I'm afraid of is that we're picking, because the ATV user population is small, we're picking out the ATV rider population to regulate them in a way that we would never do for people who take their kids snow skiing, which, I mean, every year we have people dying on the slopes, running into trees, out of control. And I just want to make sure that whatever we do here, we're not just taking an isolated community and treating them differently than we would all kinds of activities. Kids walking to school is an incredibly dangerous thing. And I don't, we can't put our kids in a bubble And I think that if you, I just want to, if I could urge, I guess, and my question is that if when we look at this particular piece of legislation, what I'd be doing is trying to make it consistent with what we do with bikes and snow skiing and those things. And I was wondering, is there any consideration to make sure we're not just pulling, in your with your committee, that you're not just pulling out ATV riders and isolating them because they're a smaller population that's not as politically powerful?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I have never, that's not what we do. And if you asked a 12-year-old, they would advocate for them to be able to drive a motor vehicle too. The issue is these are very powerful machines that go high rates of speed and weigh hundreds of pounds. If we look at per exposure, every child in this state walks. So if you look per child that's doing an activity, because there are very few children on ATVs, but their injury rate has been skyrocketing, then you cannot look at this gathering storm and not take action. I can't, in good conscience, look my patients and their families in the face when we have seen that this is a gathering storm in our state, that you look at the research that's being done across the country and it's a gathering storm. I have nothing against ATV users. Nothing. That is not what drives this. It's the injuries that we're seeing that are increasing, especially in our children, saying, what can we do to address this issue now before it becomes an even bigger problem? So yes, you look at per exposure too, and per child that's out there walking, their death and injury rate is minuscule compared to the per child on ATV and the numbers that are getting severely injured. That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to address the age issue at this point in time. Right now, we don't... The ATV community says training is woefully inadequate, and they definitely want to beef up training. They think that's a wonderful idea. Why would you want an age limit when we don't have any proof yet if we have adequate training for the families and particularly for the parents, then looking at statistics after that? I mean, to me, I think education is the key to this entire problem.
Chair Metzger, Senator Mona Sanderson, I just look at what the research says, and there, you're right, there's absolutely no research that's looked at training kids, although we have looked at training children under 16 on other motorized vehicles, and it didn't matter how much education they got when they were in charge of a motorized vehicle because of their brain development issues. They did not have the skills that were necessary to handle split-second decisions at a speed that you go on a motorized vehicle. So if the state wants to go the direction of allowing children on these vehicles and seeing if training fits it, then that's your decision, not mine. And I will just hope that you're correct and that we start stemming the numbers that are coming through our doors.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. And I certainly share your sentiment that as adults, our number one priority is to take care of our children, you know, not just send them out in diapers and think that they can take care of themselves. That is our responsibility. And I think just one thing to note, too, I mean, our current law, we were comparing with bicycles and other and motorized vehicles. The dirt bike law right now is 7 years old. And so we already have that for dirt bikes. And certainly when a dirt bike falls on you, the weight of that is significantly less than an all-terrain vehicle.
Yes.
They're much more dangerous. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm moving around here. I'm going to move around a little bit now. I'm going to ask Monty King and April McVeigh, Daryl Fuller to come forward.
Good
Whoever would like to start.
My name is Monty King. I'm president of Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association, and we oppose the bill as it's written. We just saw the -1-2 amendments today. There are tens of thousands of people out there riding these things almost every weekend. There are a lot of communities that rely on the business and the tourism that these people bring in, not only from Oregonians and out of state. The safety issue is there. But in 1984, whatever it was, when you sold 2,200 ATVs, and last year when you sold 14,000, there's a big difference there. There's a lot more ATVs. I don't think anything's gone up other than the population and the number of users. For the number of users, they're still safe. Can we get better training? Absolutely. We can train all the way down into 2, 3, 4, 5 years old if you want to. It's been noted that there's a prohibition on Class 3s on the public lands. This bill doesn't talk about public lands. It talks about lands open to the public. So you are also going to shut down all the tracks as far as any of the kids. These are major events going to be happening in the industry. Our interest is because dealers can sell ATVs and motorcycles and boats and everything else. So when these kind of things happen, we want, you know, the Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association wants to know what's going on. And I'll leave some of the other issues, but certainly we can train better. We can train online. We can train in person. There's a lot of people out here who really want to be able to do this with their families, and I don't think we should be shutting them off.
Let's go ahead.
I'm April McVeigh with Oregon Power Sports Association, and we are in line with what Monty's saying. We don't agree with the bill the way it's written. Definitely going from the public lands to premises open to the public, that's a huge array that's going to shut down a lot of things that the dealers do and who they sell to. It's a family event. It's not just the kids going out riding by themselves. And so, yes, training maybe does need to be looked at. I don't believe in book training for a 7-year-old, just like we've heard from other people. They don't have the capacity. They need to be on these rigs and riding them, and how do they gain that experience except for riding? So we'd like to see that. We've spoke with Lindy Minton, who's going to testify here, and sounds like she's going in the right direction and how to help make sure that we're getting the training, who's riding, you know, not setting those age limits, making sure that the parents are responsible. So we would, you know, support what Lindy's going after, and also just, again, we oppose the bill the way it's written.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have a question. Is there an age limit on snowmobiles or the skidoos, those things that are out on the waters?
Not that I'm aware of. On the water, there is. There is a limit. And I couldn't tell you verbatim what it is. You have to get a permit to ride, or a boater's user card. Something about.
And then the snowmobiles.
I don't believe there is on snowmobiles. They have small ones and big ones.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller for the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. Like with Mr. King, we have members who sell ATVs and motorcycles in addition to automobiles. Statistically, airline travel is the safest form of travel that we know. Everybody knows that. The statistics are mentioned time and time again, but that's hard to remember when a plane crashes and there are thousands or hundreds of people that die in airline accidents. And when that comes and is on the news, or if you have a relative or a friend who died in an airliner accident, the fact that it is statistically the safest way to travel isn't as significant anymore. If you have a child that has been injured or killed in an ATV accident, the statistics don't become important to you anymore. If you have a child that's injured in a tackle football game in high school, the fact that it is a relatively safe sport doesn't seem to matter as much anymore. I think it hurt, and I apologize if I'm not accurate, because I didn't check this because I just remembered it in the back of the room, but I believe I had heard at one point that it was more dangerous to be a cheerleader than to be a football player because of the accidents that cheerleaders have when they're doing pyramids and different things, which you don't generally think of cheerleading as a more dangerous activity than you do football playing. So if you hear stories that are just gut-wrenching stories about
children that are injured or killed in ATV accidents, that doesn't necessarily mean that riding ATVs is statistically a more dangerous activity than any number of other activities that are going on. And so I hope that we're very careful about picking and choosing which events we're going to be regulating. There are three parts of the bill that I hope that you'll take some time to deliberate on before making a decision. The first has already been mentioned, which is, to me, a real significant issue, and that's moving from public lands to private lands. I mean, that is a huge change in philosophy in terms of the state's regulation of Class 1 and Class 3 ATVs. For you to make that decision, in my mind, almost ought to be a discussion in a bill in and of itself, because that has very significant implications on private landowners and what they do with their businesses and their private lands. Right now, the regulation is public lands only. So I hope that you'll have a thoughtful discussion about that. Second, as already has been mentioned, anybody under the age of 7 already is prohibited from using a Class 1 ATV on public lands. And as you know, a two-wheeled motorcycle is pretty unstable. You have to be pretty good at balancing whether it's a bicycle or whether it's a motorcycle. It would seem to me to argue in favor of allowing younger children to ride trikes and quads because they're more stable. If you're going to train your child to be an outdoorsman and to be running around on these motorized vehicles, I would almost argue that you want to make sure that kids younger than 7 have the ability to be on the 3- and 4-wheel machines in order to learn how to ride them, and to learn the clutch and the brake and all the systems that are necessary to operate them, so that when they are old enough to go to a 2-wheel motorcycle and have to learn the balance and the other part of it, that they've got the mechanics of operating a motorized vehicle down by using a 3- or 4-wheel vehicle. And finally, I would just mention that the bill as written requires that if a child is on a Class 1 vehicle, the person, the adult supervising them, also has to be on a Class 1 vehicle. And if the child's on a Class 3, the supervisor has to be on a Class 3. And I'm not quite sure that makes any sense. It seems to me if the child is on a quad, the adult ought to be able to be riding a motorcycle and still supervise them, and vice versa. To require the parent to be on the exact same kind of vehicle with the same number of wheels in order to be qualified to supervise their child, I just, maybe there's a logical reason for that that I just don't understand, but I haven't been able to get anybody to explain to me why that's necessary. And so I would, for lack of a better term, believe there ought to be some cross-pollinization there in terms of as long as the parents are on a vehicle that can stay in contact and ride with the child, that it doesn't matter what they're in. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. I have a question. I'll ask Ms. McVay, just because it's in your written testimony. You're concerned about the ban on riders younger than 12. I would just be curious to ask you, what do you think is the age that is proper then?
I don't know that there is a proper age. Excuse me, Chair. Right. I don't know that there is a proper age. I think the issue is the parents supervising the children. Just like we've heard, everybody develops at a different age. And so what that age is, I don't know. I mean, I have a young infant. If she wants to get on and ride her little electric one, she's going to ride it. We're going to be there supervising. When she's older, you know, if she's riding a bicycle well, if there's all those things in line, we're going to put her on a quad. Whether it's on my public land or somebody else's because we're going to a friend's, you know, I want her to be able to learn how to ride with me there. And so I couldn't tell you. I mean, 3 or 4, you know, that's probably where I'm going to feel safe when I'm walking next to this child riding an ATV. On the dunes, I don't know. You know, I don't know what that number is because I don't know how she's going to develop. I think it is a parent issue. The parents need to train their children. They need to be responsible for their children.
Okay. I have one other question, and anybody can chime in on this. I'm just curious as to why you think this is the case. In our documentation here, we have the Specialty Vehicle Institute of America, which is the trade group for ATV manufacturers and distributors, mm-hmm. and their model legislation recommends that no one under the age of 16 operate an adult-size ATV that's a capacity greater than 90cc, and that no one under the age of 12 for the smaller ATVs. Now, why do you think they recommend that? Does anybody have an idea? you could come up with have an opportunity here. I'm casting with this panel right here, though.
Mr. Chairman, they're afraid of lawsuits.
Yeah, right. It's just exactly right. And why would they be afraid of lawsuits?
Because people sue them every time they get hurt.
Right.
Now, I did want to mention there are no 3-wheelers, okay? three-wheelers were phased out. Yeah. They don't right. sell them anymore because they were too dangerous. People got sued. They are afraid of lawsuits. They are going to go way, way overboard to avoid the lawsuits. As long as they can say, we didn't say do that. It's like standing on the top, you know, or the second step on a ladder. Yeah, the sign says don't do it, but you do it because you need that one, you know, extra 8 inches or whatever. They're just scared.
Well, I think you answered the question. Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like the panel, if you could, to discuss a little bit about the safety that the dealers are dealing with right now. I've been trying to get to a point today there, and kind of bringing together different charts. We've seen since 2002, according to some of the data we've gotten from earlier testimony, we've seen almost a doubling in the number of permitted ATVs in the states. We've had 100% growth in the number of permitted ATVs, and we've had a 50% increase in the number of injuries or per million. And so what I'm looking at is we've had 100% growth in ATVs. We've actually had a reduction in per ATV injury. And it seems like to me that your industry must be doing something to increase safety in this market, because actually what it looks like to me from the data that I've looked over the last few days and then the data that's been presented here today is that per ATV being sold, we're actually getting safer out there, not more dangerous. And I'm assuming that your industry is doing something proactively to make sure that there's some safety out there without government regulation. I was wondering if you could discuss that a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, excuse me, I had to do something for my cough. So, I don't think it's a 200% increase. It's a 600% increase in the number of ATVs. If you look at 1991, you got seven deaths. If you look at 2003, you got seven deaths. So I don't see that there's this massive increase. I do probably see that there's better documentation of them, but that doesn't mean there's more. Certainly you don't want anybody to die, but if you go one by one and look at the ones that died, which ones weren't wearing helmets? Which ones weren't being supervised? If you take all those out, it's a lot lower than that. But, yeah, they are doing things, you know. The training is awesome. Everybody's involved, all the franchise stores.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, and I would just say that certainly there is an education component, especially at the franchise dealers, but I would suggest to you that most of what you see there as a reduction in injuries per thousand or however is probably the all-terrain clubs. The people that are getting together and doing this as a family sport are teaching their kids, and it's not so much that there's an industry. I mean, the industry certainly backs it and supports that, but I think I would give most of the credit to the parents and to the clubs and the people that actually do this on a regular basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, folks. Linda Minton, Tom Toby, and Jody Phillips, if you'd like to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Wow, where to start? My name is Lindy Minton, mother of Jacob, Jenny, Joe, and wife of Jay. We live an idyllic life on a farm in a town much like Mayberry. I love my children more than air, and being able to connect and spend time with them as family is our most treasured gift. Thus, my involvement began in late January in opposition to Senate Bill 49 that will eliminate ATVing as a family sport. Many late nights, many phone calls, interviews.
Now, we're just remember, this is not 49. If you could,
no, I understand.
I mean, this is a lot different than 49.
But,
so,
but the information that I have,
okay,
we've acquired from that process,
okay,
if that makes any sense.
Okay, just make sure that we're talking about the legislation
apples and
that's
apples
before us. Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah.
I'm going to skip part of that. You guys have it in writing. You can review that as you'd like. The problem that we found is that we've got, you know, inaccurate the problem is we don't have accurate, unbiased information, and the statistics are nearly non-existent. Many of us have tried to obtain the information from the state of Oregon and haven't even received a response. It took a state representative to demand it, and we still only have partial information. The Consumer Product Safety Commission recently sent us the entire database,
and we have pored over this information and have tried to link it to other reporting sources. It is very complete, but the most important part of that is missing, and that's supervision. I'm tired of reading the same old news from the same people. We have a mother from Oregon who tragically lost her son. She's very involved and is the reason for Senate Bill 49. Her story is a perfect example of what is wrong, but rather than focusing on the real issues, we are sent on a wild goose chase with the blame game. Her son frequently rode alone. Although he had no injuries, he suffocated from being under the bike for over an hour. With supervision, he would be alive today. This story repeats itself over and over. This is the true epidemic. Meanwhile, valuable time passes and we still do not address the leading cause of ATV deaths and injuries. We react to the drama of the events rather than the facts. We will not hold parents accountable in their role to protect and supervise their children. We forget who the true victim is in these preventable accidents. Inflated, inaccurate numbers, and distorted stories paint a picture that is far from true. How can we bring together all the pieces of the puzzle so we can see the whole picture? How can we act as a team for the benefit of our youth? We recognize the problem. Now what do we do? As you have been made aware by contact in opposition of Senate Bill 49, our group is made up of many different folks. The main thing we have in common is a determination to keep this a safe family sport. It is our intention to become a large part of the solution. We would like to form a nonprofit group, Safety Ride, standing for Sensible Alternatives for Educating and Training Youth, funded by ATV funds. In a team approach, we will work closely with Parks and Recreation, Consumer Product Safety Commission, law enforcement, and end users. We will establish a website with pertinent information and links, a one-stop shop for all. We will coordinate with club members to receive training and instructor certification, develop Quad Squad to promote safety enforcement and environmental impact reduction through education in the recreational areas. We'll develop safety education for children in local schools, create an extensive web base for statistical data for injury and fatality reporting to be shared within state and federal agencies addressing supervision, helmets, and safety training. And most importantly today, we would like to share with you and ask for your support with our Safety Ride legislative proposal for the next session. You will find it is directed at both private and public property, requiring youth training, helmets, and supervision. It is sensible, fair, and supported by the same group that opposes Senate Bill 49 and is adamant about change with Senate Bill 101. Senate Bill 101, we will not support an age restriction of 7. We have done extensive research and have found that there have been no fatalities in this age group on public lands in the state of Oregon from 1994 to current. The prior data is incomplete. In fact, the youngest recorded death for a recreational area was 13. There were 2 6-year-olds on private property. Both were unsupervised and died from asphyxiation. The only other death under the age of 10 was a 7-year-old pedestrian who was struck by an ATV on private land. This bill addresses public lands and would have a tremendous impact on families that are riding safely with their children. If this restriction had been enacted in 1994, it wouldn't have saved any children to date. What it would have done is to prevent thousands of children from safely participating in this family activity over the course of 12 years or longer. We will support a best or rider fit as determined by an instructor for rider's eligibility. We are not satisfied with the explanation from Parks and Recreation that it seemed a good age based on the current law governing motorcycles, which they did not know where that originally came from. We request a change to the requirement that a supervising adult must be on the same class of vehicle as a child. It is completely reasonable and safe to have an adult on a Class 1 supervising a child on a Class 3 or vice versa. A grandparent may be physically unable to ride a motorcycle, but can safely supervise a child on a motorcycle from an ATV. May we suggest also that the adult training courses be designed for a joint Class 1 and 3 safety certification. Under the current language of this bill, 821-170 and 821-172 states the person operating the vehicle must be accompanied by a person who is at least 18 years of age. In 821-292, the endangering portion of it, Section 4 and 5 reads, a person commits the offense of endangering, blah, 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 if is not accompanied by the parent, legal guardian, or person with legal responsibility. Those two are in conflict with each other. In other words, an 18-year-old would satisfy the legal requirements of 821-170 and 821-172, but would be in violation of endangerment laws. Please review this language.
We agree with safety training, but request a commitment from parks requiring hands-on training for children with a rider-fit approach. Too big or too small, it's not safe at all. We will not support 20-year-old recommendations based on rider age to CCs that don't work. Consumer Product Safety Commission and the ASVI is currently revising this and moving towards speed restrictions. We support rider fit, as will be described by Tom Toby in just a minute here. There's a couple things I think that are really important. We're talking about, why are children riding adult vehicles? Well, if you have adult-sized children, you'll understand, because they don't fit on youth-sized quads or ATVs. I have an 11-year-old daughter who's almost 5'7" tall. She started in a youth model ATV. It became dangerous for her to operate her because she could not safely sit on the vehicle and use the balance that she would need to use. Her weight was towards the back of the vehicle rather than sitting like a horse, like in a saddle position, and it pulls the front end of the quad up. Not to mention that when you ride, you actually stand up on an ATV and use your weight. If you're side hilling or doing any type of thing, it's quite common for you to, you know, kind of step up a little bit like you're riding the vehicle. For her, she couldn't grip her knees. They were above the tank. It was not a good call for her to be on that bike. So we did a lot of research, and we found what we felt was the lightest, most powerful bike that she could have, because in the sand, you need the power to get up the hill. I've got pictures of my daughter. This is the motorcycle that would be recommended for her to ride under the current stipulation. As you can see, she can't turn the handlebar because her knees are in the way. This is my son on his bike. It's a 400cc Honda. It is one of the lightest adult bikes there is. It weighs 374 pounds. When you're referring to youth model ATVs, they weigh right in the neighborhood of 300 pounds. My son weighs 150 pounds. He's almost 5'10". This would be considered a perfect fit. It's already been sent to Consumer Product Safety Commission, and they said that he had the proper leg, the size, etc.
Okay, I just want to interrupt for a moment. First of all, we got about 5 minutes left of this panel because I've got to get to other folks. And you're talking about the size. You're talking about Senate Bill 49 now. It has nothing to do with this bill.
The reason why I'm bringing this up is because with a training program, it's very important that we get something from parks with regard to their training program based on CC age, the old standard from Consumer Product Safety Commission, or the new standard that is being moved to that is not based on the CC restrictions. This is something that we really need parks to take a look at, because we do support safety training, but we need to know which direction they're going to go. What it essentially would do is, if we don't address that, it would be very much like Senate Bill 49, and it could possibly restrict our children to riding bikes that are too small for them.
Okay, thank you. Let's go on, because I say I got 5 minutes left for two other people here, so I got other folks I got to get to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. Basically, our issues with 101, I think, have already been addressed in terms of the Class 1 and Class 3 being separated out.
Would you give us your name for the record?
I'm sorry. And I'm an ATV father from Southern Oregon. Got four kids, three that ride. They're under seven is cause for concern, because there really is no evidence to say why seven was even set in the bill for motorcycles, to why we even want to set that age as legislation. We believe the two problems out there with when children ride ATVs is training and supervision. Most of all, the information that we have for any deaths or serious injuries always involves a child by themselves. They're never any parent who is competent, you know, that is with them when the cause of these accidents happen. So I do agree to that point that, yes, no child should be riding an ATV, regardless of size, without any type of supervision whatsoever. And that is one of the strongest things of our bill that we're thinking of submit is driving home that they need to be accompanied by a parent or legal guardian or adult that has safety training, regardless of the size of the vehicle. Size of the vehicle, as what Lindy has just mentioned, is very limiting. It's causing kids that can't ride, or it's forcing adults to lie about the age to try to get them some type of training, which obviously makes the whole situation unsafe. So we want to push Rider Fit legislation, which allows these kids to ride a vehicle that is safe for them, provides a way for them to be into training, and allows a parent to be with them to get trained so everybody understands what we're doing while we're riding, is what we're looking at. But supervision is the largest part. It's the same thing that Lindy does with her family, I've done, Jody does with his family. This is why we've been successful as families riding, and this is why we came up with the legal information that we did in our document to what, how can we make everyone successful in the state of Oregon if you ride with youth. This is what we're doing already, and this is how we propose that.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin. Yes, hi, I'm Jody Phillips. They call me Dunehead, so it's not Dune Daddy, but I've been riding for 37 years, and we got into ATV back in 1979 when there was just three-wheelers. And I taught my 4-year-old and 6-year-old, who's now 36 and 34, and now they've got 6 and 7-year-olds. So I really like what we're doing in terms of getting the training and getting the supervision because, like I said, I go riding a lot, primarily in the dunes. I see a lot of kids out there with no supervision, a lot of times no helmets, and it's like we really do need to put something to wrap around that because I agree. I'm also a healthcare sales rep, and I go into the ORs and the emergency rooms, and I know that vast majority of the times it's kids unsupervised and untrained. So I think for Senate Bill 101, I totally disagree with the age limit. I firmly believe that should be a parent's discretion based on the, you know, their kid and how developed they are and the size of the ATV. And I also partially agree and disagree with the CC size. I think with the motorcycles that you have today, CC is not a good representation necessarily of what a kid would fit, if you will. You have to have the right size and weight ratio and power. And we really need to look at that because a 5'10" is not going to fit on a 90cc. I don't know if you guys have ever physically seen one. You ought to go take a look at it because you'll realize that it's just not appropriate at all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think I'll dismiss this panel right now and ask so we can try to see if we get a couple more folks on.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Can I add one more thing?
Yes.
You brought up the question about the SVIA in terms of their current. Actually, the SVIA is going through a change in how they understand the age of CC, that they're actually changing that. The SVIA does not support, the SVIA does not support a blanket minimum age of 12 years old for operation. They believe that rider education and supervision for children under 16 is the most effective means to enhancing rider safety. And the SVIA is also in the process of updating, like we had talked about, the age of CC. Rather than basing age parameters on ATV displacement, the new voluntary standard would incorporate basically limiting speed and not size of the ATV. So both the SVIA and the CPSC are moving away from the old language drafted back in the 80s on 90cc and 70cc for children under 16.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you very much, folks. We got a few bit more minutes. I'm going to get a couple on each side of this before we can move into our next bill. So I'm going to ask Edward Arenello and Bev Stubbs to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you.
Proceed. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, please.
I want to introduce myself. My name is Ed Arenello. I'm a father. I'm of a 3.5-year-old and a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old. And we've all been through many sports and activities. But first, I want to say that I think the intent here is safety. And it's always about safety. It really is about safety. And I've watched, being in the retail industry, I've watched the snowboarding industry save the mountains at a rate that was somewhere in the order of 30% growth, which is the same growth rate with the ATV business that's been going on. People flow with where the activities in the public go. But I can tell you, we don't govern hiking, running, my child chasing the ball, my child, when I allow my child to take off on the bike, or when I take the training wheels off, when they swim, when they ski, or when they snowboard. I've been involved in the community a long time, from the March of Dimes to the Red Cross, which happens to be right outside the door. I've tried to save kids that have been hit with snowboards in the head when clear fluids coming out of their nose and their ears. I've seen it all. I'm the son of a surgeon, an ER doctor, and I've seen those things firsthand when you used to be able to go into the rooms. And I've helped all kinds of people on the sidelines. But I'll tell you, we are way premature here on this. The safety is one thing, but governing the age and governing what bike is right for, you've heard the different arguments, what bike is right for what, who's right, who's wrong, is way immature in the process. The ATV Allocation Committee is a confusing committee in itself. It's approved of, you're approved to be on that committee by the group that approves, that gets a proposal to the end road, and it doesn't make sense. It doesn't get you what the public really needs. After that, I'll tell you that I am president of the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association. We represent over 500 members. We represent most of the events that go on in the state. We represent recreationalists from motorcycles to ATVs, and we represent safety. And safety is key. But when does parental responsibility start and end? And when does government's responsibility start and end? Who's to say, and you've heard different facts, and I'm going to emphasize that we need to go further on this without any approvals of who goes what age on what bike. Where are the injuries? 3 to 12, 12 to 16, 16 to 25, 25 to 35, 35 to 45. My son, who's 15, I'm more nervous about him driving a car, than I am of the choice that he chose that motorcycle riding and ATV riding was safer than football. I'm more concerned that my daughter, who was injured permanently in the knee cheerleading, chose to ride her ATV avidly since the age of 10. Those are choices that we make and we educate. We choose to take a family event like my 3-year-old here that I took safely in a pouch to the Oregon Dunes, to the ocean, to see the ocean experience, that now at 3, we're developing on a very small quad that hasn't been brought up, that has a restrictor. There are all kinds of other safety mechanisms that have not been brought up, yet we're ready to dive into a law. And it just doesn't make sense. So where does it start? When does the accident really occur? And wouldn't you or I be mostly afraid of the 16 to 25-year-olds that are out there? I'd be afraid of myself as I look back, let me tell you. I grew up cruising 82nd, went to Benson High School, had no business behind a car. Most important thing was either my girlfriend or gas money. My parents were afraid for me. That's where we're really afraid. Are we afraid when they're with the parents, when the parents take responsibility? No. It's the 16-year-old kid that I've been mentoring and is now 23 that, thank God, my wife and I were there, and he's alive at 23. Because he probably wouldn't have been, because he would have been one of those fatalities or an injury on his Banshee out on the dunes going gangbusters. His parents weren't there. That was the issue, not whether or not government was there. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much.
Hi. My name's Bev Stubbs, and I'm nervous.
You're right. You're fine.
I've been riding ATVs and motorcycles for 45 years, basically most of my life. I didn't think I'd be like this. I have children and grandchildren. I have a grandson who is now 6. We started him on his first ATV at 2.5. It was a 50cc. We trained him very well. We turned the governor in. He's never been allowed to ride unattended. He's always had adult supervision. He always rides all of his gear, wears all of his gear. He also knows that if he doesn't obey and do what we tell him, his bike is gone. It will be put away. He won't be allowed to ride. He's now 6. He can finally have an ATV safety course, which he will be taking at spring break. The lady from SIA is coming down to my house to give all of my grandchildren and one of our employees' grandson their ATV safety course because they couldn't have it beforehand. But now that they're 6, they can have it. He has to go back to his little bike. He cannot stay on his 80 to take his course, which is what he rides now. On Senate Bill 101, I agree that they need to have more safety, the training for the kids. However, I think the little kids, need to have hands-on. Sitting them in front of a computer or a TV screen is not going to work. they need the hands-on training. They learn better if they can physically do what they're supposed to be doing. And adult supervision. There should always be adult supervision. And 101 is great, but it needs some tweaking because it won't work. I mean, adults need to be there. They need the courses. And as far as the riding, there's a clause in this, I believe, unless it's been changed, for the riding double. And I don't think anybody under the age of 16 or 18 should have a passenger with them unless there's a situation and they're 16, 17 years old and they're out there with somebody and somebody is injured and it's a small child. They can't leave that child unattended. The bike breaks down. Then they need to bring that person back to get help. Then that's an exception to the rule. And also, it's been brought up today, too, about the mixing of the quad and the motorcycle. If you're out there, like, we ride quads, ATVs. We don't ride motorcycles in the sand. But if I was on an ATV and my grandson was on a motorcycle, that should be okay. It should be changed so that you can be on one or the other, not both the same bike. And a lot of the stuff that other people have said today, I agree with. So.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Is there questions for either of our two witnesses?
Oh, I know what. I had one more thing. On yes. my letter that I
We have your written testimony, yes?
I have put some pictures on there. The first picture you see, I'm sorry, is this boy is 14 years old. The top picture, he's sitting on a little 70. Mm-hmm. On the bottom picture, he's sitting on a 250cc bike. The reason that we're talking about, that was the other thing, is we need to do a size fit to the children, not a CC size. This right here, this picture alone, tells why we need to fit the kids to the bike. He's way too big for that little bike. If he shifts his weight, he will tip it over. It will not work. And then on the other page is the 14-year-old is my niece, and she's on a 250cc. The other one is my grandson, and he's on an 80cc. And they fit those bikes. They handle those bikes just fine. And they're never allowed to ride unattended. There's always an adult, and they always wear all their gear. We have ridden for years. My grandson, the six-year-old, has been hurt worse on his bicycle than he has in the 3 years he's been riding quads. So there is something we need to fix. We just don't need to radically do it, but we need to do it so the kids get what they need.
Okay, thank you very much. And you did great, by the way.
Thanks.
Thank you, both of you. I've got to get this wrapped up so we can go on to the next bill. So I'm going to ask that Dr. Jim Blaise come forward. And Walt Marquis, would you come up here as well? And we'll conclude today on this piece of legislation so we can move on. We've got through most everybody. I realize not everyone, but just about. Or at least we got the arguments out, I think, pretty well. I'll let you guys conclude. Dr. Blaise, I'll ask you to go, and then I'll just basically ask Mr. Marquis for just any comments that he had about some of the testimony we heard today.
Chairman Metzger and members of the panel, I'm Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I've been in practice for 30 years. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Pediatric Society, and I'm also on the Oregon Safe Kids Committee. And I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 101. And you heard a lot of discussions. We do actually have a study from the state of Oregon that came through OHSU, statewide assessment of injury and death rates among riders of off-road vehicles treated at trauma centers. So we actually have our own Oregon data, if you want, came out this year. We'll make copies of that for the committee, and they do notice an increasing and alarming rate of injuries sustained on ATVs. So it's not something that people are making up or pretending that it's happening. There's an actual increase, whether it's coupled because of increasing riders or unsupervised children. There's lots of issues that are within that, but we do have that. As a pediatrician, I'm always in favor of prevention, and if we can reduce the injuries sustained with activities that our children do, we're in favor of them. There's a little picture that we included. That's Claudia Black on top of an ATV. That's an actually 90cc ATV, and she fits on that. She still has 5 inches between her knees and the front. So everybody can throw pictures out and show how people fit on different ATVs, but she's 6 foot tall, and she actually fits on that. So, but that's a side issue in case that question came up. The issue comes up about what age is safe. Is there a safe age or not? The industry says 16 and under, was because of lawsuits, or it's actually because of what we do with training, how the brain works, and all these activities. Is it 7? Is it 12? We would actually favor the 16, but we'd be happy to settle at 12. I know that won't go over well with the ATV community. A lot of family activities will be disrupted. Again, we're just looking at preventing injuries, and if that would make a difference. And as we go on, I think we'll be accumulating more information, and if we don't do anything this session, and the injury rate continues to climb, I promise you issue will be back again next session, you know, with some other legislation that will be addressing that. And I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Lacy. I appreciate all your advocacy that you do for kids. Is it Trooper?
Captain.
Captain. Sorry. Captain Markey, I would just would be curious, if you're involved with enforcement in this arena, and would be curious as to your observations as we close today's part of the hearing on what you've heard today and your own personal experiences.
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Walt Markey. I'm a captain of the Oregon State Police. I'm in charge of the Fish and Wildlife Division. So I supervise 119 game officers who patrol the woods in the state of Oregon.
We'll try to get you some more soon.
Great. Okay. I think it's my experience is going to be that we typically enforce areas where these ATVers is not an open area. You know, what we've seen over the years is, particularly during the fall when their hunting seasons are on, these hunting camps went from no ATVs to almost every camp has an ATV now. And that's probably our number one complaint during hunting season, is that these ATV operators are operating in closed areas behind locked gates and road closures that are designed to protect habitat, to allow some escapement for animals and stuff like that. But we certainly do investigate accidents, including serious death and injuries. Usually those are in very remote areas where it takes a considerable amount of effort or time to get to those areas or to get those people out of those areas. Our three highest activities where we would either issue a citation or a warning would be operating an ATV with a loaded firearm, operating on a highway, or in posted restricted areas. But whether it's a person who's 7 years old should be operating an ATV or not, I think that's certainly up to the individual. And I don't think this is very unlike any other activity, that the parents need to be responsible. I've heard a lot of people testify today that they are responsible, but I would suggest that the ones who aren't responsible probably aren't here today. And that's certainly what we see in all kinds of activities, whether it's boating, swimming, fishing, hunting, is that we encounter problems when there is not proper supervision. And I think that's why we set up rules and regulations to get the people who don't supervise to force them to do so.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think that's true in most cases, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Thank you very much. Questions for either of our panels?
Could I make one clarification?
Yes, please.
We talked about, you heard testimony about deaths, but actually you have to be interested in the morbidity. In other words, the children who don't die. The serious head injuries, neck injuries, the quads, the diplegics, all these things that come out of these accidents. That's where you see the large increase of the number of children that are treated who don't die.
Thank you. And thank you we do have a copy of the study that was provided. Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question for the captain, and I understand this is obviously somewhat of a difficult issue, and this isn't quantifiable like the OHSU study, which obviously is quantifiable. But have you seen in the last 3 or 4 years an uptick in terms of numbers of cases that you're responding to of children unsupervised, since that's the nature of the legislation on both Senate Bill 101 and 49, and or if they are supervised, accidents, where you're having to respond to more accidents involving ATVs with children or not?
With children?
Only children.
Because of our duties as fish and wildlife officers, we don't typically go out and onto the dunes and patrol people who are riding ATVs. We don't necessarily do that. The way the ATV fund is set up is designed to give money to enforcement of areas that are open. And as I testified earlier, there's actually an amendment to the bill to change that, but we enforce areas that aren't necessarily open. So we spend a considerable amount of time checking ATVs, doing inspections, writing citations, doing chasing people down or behind road closures and stuff. But the way the ATV fund is set up, it doesn't allow the state parks to transfer funds to the state police to pay for that. So I think my experience is most of these families that take these smaller kids out are probably in open areas in the dunes or in these trails that have been built. They're not necessarily up in the woods where we typically see them. So I can't, my experience doesn't help me answer that question very well. Do you understand?
Yeah, I do. Any
other questions? Thank you both very much. I think there's a couple people we didn't get up, but I need to move on. I think we got most of the issues up for this moment. I think we got some really good information today for the committee. clearly the one universal comment I heard is an agreement that adults need to be responsible, that training for adults is something that we do need to look at, and supervision as part of this. So, you know, we'll continue that discussion. Thank everybody for their input on this. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 101. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 645. Janet.
Mr. Chair and members, you have the original bill and you should have the dash one amendments. The original bill would have established a crime of unauthorized use of a shopping cart
by anyone under 7 years of age, right? Oh, no, I'm sorry.
And created a system for reporting abandoned shopping carts and picking them up. We probably want to concentrate more on the dash one amendments because I'm not sure anyone is supporting the original bill any longer, which would authorize local governments to enact ordinances to prohibit unauthorized appropriation of shopping carts. It would also provide for salvage of those carts for the businesses that own them and require the owners, if such an ordinance passes by local government, require the owners to post signs on the premises that removal is a crime and to post those same signs on the cart itself, and to provide a toll-free number to report abandoned carts, to retrieve carts within 72 hours. And the ordinance would also provide that the local government could take custody of the abandoned cart after 72 hours beyond the notice period, or the owner could be fined up to $50. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. And you may have read about this bill in the Weekly Democrat. And only kidding. But the just as a reminder, members, as Janet pointed out, so we're actually looking at the dash one, which is a whole gut and stuff of the original bill. So that's what we're dealing with today. And our chief sponsor, Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm delighted. I'm Senator Lori Mona Sanderson from the Gresham, Fairview, Troutdale, and Wood Village area. This bill, there were a number of reasons why I decided to be chief sponsor of this bill. And it started out with a Gresham City Councilor coming to me and saying they were thinking about doing an ordinance to take care of the nuisance that these shopping carts were having throughout the neighborhoods. And so I let that go. And then not more than a couple months later, I have a rental, and my rentees, they do not have a car. They have brought two shopping carts, and they were on my property. Then the Grocers Association approached me and said, hey, would you like to sponsor this bill? And I felt the stars were aligned and that I was actually supposed to be a chief sponsor of this bill. I truly feel that there are going to be a number of cities that are going to address this issue, and I'm going to let the Grocers Association explain to you the particulars of it. But if it'll be far easier for the grocers if there's sort of a standard that every jurisdiction should follow in order to make sure that all the grocery carts get back to the stores. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. With that introduction, Mr. Floyd.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Dan Floyd. I represent the Northwest Grocery Association, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 645. The first thing I want to point out is that I'm glad you made it clear that we didn't support creating a new crime. I said something like 5 years imprisonment, and we even think that's crazy. So I'm glad that's not there. I wanted to outline the problem for you, just our membership. So our members in the Portland metropolitan area, which would range from as far west as Hillsboro to as far east as the Gresham-Troutdale area, those members, and then the members in Salem, they lose 3,500 carts a week. So I mean, you see how significant it is, and that's just for our membership. Those carts are worth anywhere between $100 and $300, depending on the size of the cart and the makeup of the cart. It costs us right now anywhere between $1 to $3 to retrieve those carts. And right now, the problem is, now, I'm sorry, with 3,500 carts leaving, some of those do come back, but we're out there retrieving them. Our efforts right now are they aren't coordinated, and we have different methods ranging from using a cart retrieval service to employing a neighbor or sending out a storm employee. So with the efforts not being coordinated, obviously we're not doing our job yet. And so this is a plan that, you know, working with cities like Salem, Beaverton, Gresham, and a number of other interested cities at this point, we've come together with a plan that the neighborhood associations can support, the grocers can support, and the cities can support. I believe you do have a letter in front of you from Mayor Drake from the city of Beaverton. The plan simply outlines the parameters. So it's not saying that this is a statewide mandate that every city must have a local shopping cart ordinance. However, it's saying that if you do adopt a local shopping cart ordinance, this is what the group came forward with as the best method. It's a public-private partnership. I emphasize private because we will be funding a 1-800 number and a cart retrieval service to get these carts back to our stores. It's a valuable asset for us. There will be a 24-hour toll-free number that will be posted on all the carts and around the premises of the store, around cart corrals, so it's clear that there's the number is there and that that citizens can access that number by calling, but then there'll also be a website so they can report abandoned shopping cart on the web. The second part for us, and like I said, there are postage requirements, one on the carts. On the carts, we're going to reference the general theft statute, so we're not creating a crime. It's already theft to take the cart. We're not advocating for anything beyond what we currently have. Secondly, the toll-free number and the website will be on there. The second part, we're posting signs around cart corrals and the lots, like I said. Hopefully, from that point, once the cart is reported abandoned to that 1-800 number, we're taking care of the problem right there. Once that cart is reported, our cart retrieval service is notified immediately. The city is also notified, so the local jurisdiction knows when their clock starts. From that point, we have 72 hours, or the retailers will have 72 hours, to go out and get that cart off the street and back to the retailer. So, like I said, hopefully we don't have to go to step five, which is what you see next there. And that is if we fail to do our job, if we are unable to get those carts off the streets, off the parking strips, apartment complexes, and back to the retailers within 72 hours, the city has the option to go out and take possession of that cart and place a fine of $50 on that the given retailer. The $50, in our opinion, that $50 covers the cost of retrieval. And you know, like I said, we did a survey amongst our own members showing that to retrieve the carts, we were paying anywhere between $1 and $3. So hopefully that $50 will cover the retrieval costs and then also provide that incentive for the retailers that aren't doing their part right now to get involved and go out and remove those carts, get them back to the retailers.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Floyd. So just to be clear, then, and we've talked about this before in advance of this meeting, that the real issue here is because there is a tremendous cost to retailers with these carts, and we all see them. Besides just the unsightliness of them, there's a business cost involved here. And to allow municipalities to set these uniform type retrieval areas that, just from a business standpoint, it's more valuable for you to get the carts back than it is to wonder about picking them up. And it is amazing where you see some of these things and how they get there. I think having continuity is really important as well. I think you've done a good job on that. Questions for either the Senator or Mr. Floyd?
Laurie said she'd had pictures of her in a cart.
Yeah. Kate, is it Tartar? Mm-hmm. Okay. If you want to come forward.
That's right.
And if you wanted to stay there because we have some questions, that'd be fine. Kate's the only one else signed up. We got a lot of people lurking in the back, but they didn't sign up. So.
Okay. As you said, my name is Kate Tartar, and I'm the chair of the Northgate Neighborhood Association, and we were big advocates for cleanup of abandoned shopping carts in our area. We host Make a Difference Day, and shopping carts were one of the items we couldn't get rid of at the end of the day. Anyway, I hosted a meeting at the Salem-Keizer Transit with the topic being solutions for abandoned shopping carts, and the Grocers Association showed up with that, and we eventually ended up on a committee through the City of Salem, which was to address abandoned shopping carts. And I just am really thankful to the Grocers Association for stepping up and finding a solution that works for the businesses, and I think that they are the best ones to advocate for the solution. And we are thankful for one number versus all the rest. The other thing this would give us is we don't have to deal with the individual store managers. We can call the one number and be done. And it's the same format you have for graffiti. We send it in on the website. We call it in. We're just really involved in our community and taking care of it. And I just can't thank the Grocers Association enough for coming up with this solution.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Tarter? Well, I should both stay right there. Yes, Linda Ludwig, if you'd like to come forward. And by the way, as she's coming forward, you see a letter that we have from Mayor Drake from the city of Beaverton expressing their support for Senate Bill 1645. Welcome.
Good afternoon, City. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I have to admit, I was just handed this file about 10 minutes ago, and I don't have a large background in this issue. However, there, a couple of concerns have rolled up through our staff that I wanted to bring forward to you today. First of all, I would...
Are you referring to the Dash 1 now?
Yes,
are referring to the Dash 1, okay.
Yes, Senator, Mr. Okay. Chair. Very much appreciate the work that has gone into the Dash 1 and the program here that is privately sector funded by the private sector and the interaction with some of our large cities, Gresham, Portland, Salem. My concern is really only directed to our very small communities. And from my read, and it's a quick read of the Dash Ones, if we had a small community that had several grocery stores but still had a problem to a certain degree with their carts migrating out and being around in the town or the city, that small city would have to follow the ordinance restrictions that are laid out here, which includes having their business owners make investments for a toll-free phone line as well as transportation for those carts. It wouldn't allow a small jurisdiction trying to do something different, do the right thing to, say, pass a code violation ordinance to deal with those carts and not put the burden on just a small number of businesses within their small community. That's my only concern with this. We haven't had much time to look at it to make some small tweaks, suggestions for small tweaks in the language, which I'm certain they'd only be small because we do support the bill overall.
Okay, well, thank you. We'll ask Mr. Floyd to respond to that since he represents the businesses here.
Sure. Chair Metzger, as far as the business responsibility, whether it's the Portland-Salem area that I'm talking about today or if we're going out to Pendleton or LeGrand or Bend, wherever, we support this plan and we're willing to implement the same plan in any city. So, and we initially responded to cities that had a problem, and we responded because it's our property that we're losing and we really want that back. And at the same time, the cities were noticing that it was a problem for them because it ends up in neighborhoods and apartment complexes. So it's a proactive approach, and if it's a problem in another city, I guarantee we're going to be the first people, the retailers are going to be the first ones to notice that it's a problem there. We're going to want to implement the same program and get those carts back to our retailers and off the streets as soon as possible. We're okay with the initial burden, or the increased burden if we're going to other communities.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Do you, when I first read this, I figured a 1-800 number that blanketed the whole state. Do you envision separate 800 numbers or toll-free numbers in each jurisdiction?
Senator Metzger, or Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, right now I know that this 1-800 number will cover our entire membership, and if other retailers would like to be underneath the same 1-800 number, we'd be glad to accommodate them. If they want a separate 1-800 number, that's fine, and they can do whatever they want, but we're willing to accommodate them. I don't see there being all kinds of different numbers. Either way, the number is going to end up on the shopping cart and around the cart premise, so when someone wants to report an abandoned shopping cart, that number is available for them. That tool will still be there for them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Martin.
And I think it's important to note that this is only when a local government wants to enact or adopt an ordinance or a charter. So it could be that in the smaller communities they don't have the issue that, say, a larger city would have. And so I think that it may be a moot point comparing a very small jurisdiction with only one or two big stores.
Any other questions? I just want to address one to Ms. Ludwig because I appreciate your comment. I guess my only comment on that would be, since the heat would be taken by Mr. Floyd and his members on that, and they're willing to share that burden. I think this is you know, something that I certainly feel comfortable with, you know, and giving the cities the tools to do this. So it's some way to clean up our cities and maybe provide a cottage industry for someone to help restore some of these carts somewhere.
Chair, if I would ask one last question. Of the 242 cities in the state, how many are members of the Grocery Association?
I don't think the cities are.
But how many have memberships of those cities?
Mr. Floyd, or maybe others in the back of the room might be able to answer that question.
Chair Masker, I believe the question is how many of our cities have Grocery Association members in them. I don't know if we have all 242, but I'd be surprised if we didn't have members in all 242 cities. I can verify that, but I'd be shocked if we didn't.
Okay. Thank you. Nobody else has signed up to testify, but we have a lot of interested parties. Anybody else have any comments on this bill? Okay. Committee, I'm comfortable. If you're comfortable, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 645 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 645.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 645. Further discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Would like to point out that I have had emails from all over the world on this issue, and even from a couple of other states. And evidently, a system like this has not been implemented anywhere in the United States, and everyone seems to be interested in this topic, including people from Japan and from Europe.
Well, let's just hope that Mr. Floyd doesn't have to go pick up a cart in Thailand because the $50 threshold may not be worth it.
Yeah.
Senator Starr.
I would just also point out that this is not a mandate on local governments. The word is may.
That's right.
So local governments have a choice. I would encourage them to work cooperatively with the grocers in their communities. And if this isn't the program for a certain community, they have opportunities to do other things. But this is a may, and I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the industry. I recognize their vested interest in it, but also the vested interest of, you know, the blight that these things create, too, and coming up with a solution and bringing it to us. All right, we have a Dash 1 amendment before us. Is there any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the bill as amended to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 645 as amended by the Dash 1 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and we'll ask Senator Montes Anderson to carry on the floor, and we are adjourned. Thank you.